Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is the founder and the chancellor of Or Torah Stone Institutions, which is a network of high schools and colleges and graduate programs, seminaries, and rabbinical schools in the U.S. and Israel, with the total student enrollment, which is now numbering in the thousands, actually. I'm actually privileged to teach Jewish ethics and philosophy in one of those institutions, Yeshivat Machanaim in Efrat. Rabbi Riskin is, of course, the founding rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue on the Upper West Side of New York City, which he led for 12 years, and after Aliyah in 1983, became the founding chief rabbi of Efrat. He graduated summa cum laude from Yeshiva University in 1960, where he received rabbinic ordination under the guidance of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. In 1963, Rabbi Riskin received his master's degree in Jewish history and completed a PhD from NYU. In 1982. From 1963 until 1977, he lectured and served as an associate professor of Tanakh and Talmud at Yeshiva University. During the 60s and the 70s, he was deeply involved in the movement to free Soviet Jewry, and he made several trips to the USSR. He and his wife, Vicky, have four children and 17 grandchildren.
Eight children, including the in-laws.
There you go. Please welcome Shlomo Riskin. All right, so let's begin at the beginning. Tell me about Brooklyn in the 1940s. You were raised in a non-observant household, strictly speaking, but obviously you had various influences on your Judaism. Tell me about the way Judaism manifested or didn't manifest in your household and how you yourself came to observance.
It's difficult to say non-observant, the fact is that the neighborhood had been changing. We were the last Caucasians on the block. But I had a wonderful relationship with the African Americans. I was rather bookish, not too athletic. I wore my kippah, which they called the Jew beanie, and they sort of liked. They saw me go to the library every Friday and take out four books, and that interested them. So we used to play stickball in the gutter, and Skelly, remember what Skelly was. There were Johnny pumps in case of fire, but that was our swimming pool in the summertime. And we just took off our trousers and went into the Johnny pump water. And it did the job of cooling us off. And they used to fight over me to be on their team, especially on stickball team in the gutters. But they never let me get up to the bat because I really was not athletic at all. But I was like their good luck charm. But it was fine because I was sort of protected. Religiously, my mother's mother was very deeply religious. Actually, my mother's parents were very deeply religious. My mother's mother, when I was 8, lost her husband, my grandfather. And from age 10 until age 20, I spent Friday afternoon, Friday evenings, praying with her, studying Bible with her over dinner, until my bar mitzvah. She made kiddush. After my bar mitzvah, I made kiddush for her, singing zmirot. We studied Bible with Yiddishkeit, and she taught me Masechet Brachot, Talmud. Her father, my great-grandfather, after whom I'm named, Rabbi Shlomo Kowalski, was the dayan, or the judge, in this very small town of Lublin, in Wrocław Gubernia, in Poland. My grandmother would regale me with stories of this small shtetl, which had exactly 300 homes, 300 families, 150 Polish, and 150 Jewish. Her father, the Dayan, was also a rabbi, Rabbi Petrov. Her father was the Rabina of the Rabina, was the Dayan or the judge. He, at first, had four daughters before the sons began coming. He wanted to teach somebody, and my grandmother wanted to learn. So it began with Bible, Rashi, Ramban. Then she asked for Mishnah, and he taught her Mishnah. And then she asked her for Gemara, and he taught her Gemara. So she taught me Masechet Brachot. I thought every older grandmother from Europe knew how to learn Gemara. But for me, the Friday nights with her were intensely religious experiences. My father's father was a communist ideologue who came to America in 1908 from Siberia. He organized the workers in his father's factory. His father produced the war garb for the Tsar. And my grandfather, who was a real idealist, communist idealist, organized the workers against his father and was sent to Siberia, escaped from Siberia, and came to New York. He was an intellectual. He wrote an article for a weekly newspaper in Yiddish called Freiheit. It was the Communist Daily Worker. It was the Communist Yiddish paper. And he was a very special person. I say an idealist because he came with his 10 fingers. He was very talented. And he started making things out of wood. And he was a woodworker. And when the business took off, he gave the business to his partners, and he only took one share himself, because that's what communism believed. My grandmother didn't talk to him for 6 months after that. They began to make money. I remember this very, very clearly. They began to make money, and then he gave it to the workers. But he was the real McCoy, and he thought that communism would bring tikkun olam. My place of bonding with my father and grandfather, if you know what this is, it was a schwitz. A sauna is a poor, pale imitation of a schwitz. A schwitz is a really very hot steam room. They would give massages. My father was the king of the schwitz. He knew how to give massages better than anybody else. And I was not athletic. My father was very athletic. He played semi-professional baseball. We bonded in the schwitz because I could take a lot of heat. I think I can still take a lot of heat. So that made my father proud of me. My grandfather and I used to have real ideological arguments about atheism. Anyway, my grandmother taught me Gemara, and my grandfather taught me Yiddish through the writings of Shalom Aleichem. I went to a day school because in the public schools, the African Americans and the Italians were at war with each other, and they went to school with knives, not with school books. So my parents sent me to a day school, the principal of which was Rav Menachem Manis Mandel, from Torah Vidas, close to the Satmar Rebbe, but a very wonderful, wonderful human being, knew my father didn't go to shul, waited for me every Saturday morning in front of the apartment house in which I lived, 103 Hart Street in Bedford Stuy, walked with me to the shul within the yeshiva of Brooklyn, Shabbat morning, I still love, best of all, the Keladon prayer, because he used to embrace me with his prayer shawl, and I could hear his voice. He had a very beautiful voice. And he would sing quietly, chant the prayers. And then he walked me home with him to 83 Wilson Street in Williamsburg. That's where I had lunch. And then one of his older daughters would take me back home to Bedford-Stuyvesant. One interesting thing about my grandfather, however, my communist grandfather, one of my earliest memories, I think my earliest memory at age 3, he made me a table and chairs, small table and small chair, which is still in the family. One of my sisters has it, actually, or one of her children. So it's still in the family. And after he gave it to me, he asked me to, if I could make my fingers like this. And I was able to. And he kissed me on my forehead. And he said, "Remember, we are Kohanim. And Kohanim are Jewish aristocracy. Never marry a non-Jew." The other strong memory I have, very deeply embedded, we were on the train going to his house on King's Highway, was where he lived with my grandmother. And there were 2 Hasidim sitting across from us. We were talking ideology. That's what he loved to do. We were talking ideology. And he treated me as a total adult, and I appreciated it tremendously. And a few toughs came into the train car and started making fun of the 2 Hasidim and their garb and their peyot. And my grandfather was very distracted. He wasn't listening, forgot about the conversation, was just intently watching the toughs and the Hasidim. I remember him as being a very tall man, but everything is in comparison, so I guess he wasn't that tall. But I remember him as being a very tall man and a very strong man. And when the car stopped, the train car stopped, the doors opened, my grandfather suddenly lunged forward and picked up 3 toughs and threw them off the train. I was a little frightened. And I remember saying to my grandfather, "But you're not religious. Why were you protecting the Hasidim?" And he said, "Because they are our family. And you always have to protect family." My other memory of the grandfather, he taught me Yiddish, as I said. And for my bar mitzvah, I couldn't read Haftorah because I'm fairly tone deaf. So, I did read Haftorah, but I couldn't read the Torah. So at that time anyway, it wasn't the custom even for everybody to read the Parsha. And I couldn't learn the cantillation tunes too well. So I just read the Haftorah. But I had an hour and a half Talmudic discourse in Yiddish. A shiur of Reb Chaim Riska, Hasach ben Tfila Letfila. I still remember it pretty well. And my grandfather helped me with the discourse, the Yiddish. And then, he told me the Saturday night before the Shabbat of my bar mitzvah in the Schwitz, he said that next week I can't come to your bar mitzvah. I'll come to the party, but I can't come to the synagogue. And I was very upset. I looked at him. I said, "What do you mean you can't come?" He said, "I can't come. Because at my bar mitzvah Shabbat, I took an oath that I would never step into a synagogue again." I've thought since had I had the brains then that I got later, I would have asked him, who did you make the oath to? But I just started to cry. And my father whispered to me, you know, my father was very stubborn. It's not going to help. He made up his mind. Anyway, the next Shabbat, I got up to give the drasha, to give the long pilpul, the Talmudic discourse. And just as I was beginning, I saw my grandfather walk into the synagogue. Apparently he was in the vestibule waiting outside until I would begin to speak. And he came in for the speech. He sat right near me. After I finished, he kissed me on my forehead, and he handed me a brown paper bag in which were two books, Das Kapital by Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto. I think I was the only bar mitzvah boy to receive such a gift. But I imagine that's the way he assuaged his conscience.
Tell me about later on. How did you decide about going to Yeshiva University? And tell me about the very, very first time that you met Rabbi Soloveitchik.
How did I decide to go to Yeshiva University? Well, as I said, we were pretty poor. After elementary school, I would have loved to continue on to yeshiva. I loved learning, and especially Torah learning. But again, yeshivot charged tuition. My parents said it was out of the question. So I got into Brooklyn Tech, and that was free. The summer after my graduation from elementary school, I was 12. Couldn't afford camp. I was tired of playing stickball. Once a week, I got car fare to go to the 42nd Street Library, the Jewish reading room. And I went there. The other days of the week, from my house, it was not so far, it was maybe a mile walk, I went to Yeshiva University High School of Brooklyn. Church in Bedford. And it wasn't too long a walk, and I went there every day. The administrator of the school was a man named Mr. Levine. Mr. Levine, he had a gravelly voice, noticed me, asked me what I was doing in the library, and I said, I like to study, and this is an open library, and I appreciate the opportunity. He said, where are you going next year? And I said, I'm going to Brooklyn Tech. I just graduated from the Yeshiva of Brooklyn. He said, why don't you come to us, to this yeshiva? I said, we can't afford the tuition. He said, you have a full scholarship. So I was very grateful, and that's where I went, Yeshiva University High School of Brooklyn. At the end of high school, I received a full scholarship to Harvard. My parents were ecstatic, and I was supposed to be a lawyer and kind of bring the family out of poverty as a lawyer. I memorized all of Clarence Darrow's speeches. I had a different image of a lawyer, but we were on the same page, basically, professionally. And right before Shavuot, I went to Yeshiva University to learn all night. The night of Shavuot. That was Washington Heights. It was a special thing. I believe Yeshiva University High School of Brooklyn kind of sponsored it, would ask the boys to go to encourage the students to continue on at Yeshiva College. It was a wonderful night of learning in the Beit Midrash. And the Mashgiach Ruchani of Yeshiva University was Rabbi Yitzchak Lessin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, a Slabotka, very special personage. He didn't really understand the language or the culture of the students, but he was strikingly handsome and immaculate, with a long black gabardine kapata that was always immaculate, and a white forked beard. Very impressive figure. And at the end of the prayer service, on Yom Tov, there's Birkat Kohanim, and I'm a Kohen, and he was a Kohen. And he the very beautiful Slabotka Nigin, he would sing the priestly benediction. Excuse me. And I was exceedingly moved. And I took an oath during the priestly benediction that if at all possible, I would do whatever I could to get to Yeshiva University and to continue Torah study and not go to Harvard. I had a grand aunt who lived in Washington Heights, Laurel Hill Terrace. I went to see her. She was my grandmother's sister. She wasn't observant. She was smart and forceful. I'm sorry. And I told her I would like to go to Yeshiva University. She said, no problem. I'm on the vole. I said, you're on the what? I'm on the vole. There's a vole at Yeshiva with names. My name is on the vole. W-A-L-L, the vole. Now at that time I think if you gave $100, you got your name on the wall. She was sure she would get me in. So I stayed over another night. The next morning, we went to Dr. Belkin's office. He was the president. We went to Dr. Belkin's office. He was obviously otherwise engaged. She opened up the door. Dr. Belkin, this is my grandnephew. I'm on the ball. He's a genius. I want him to get into yeshiva. I'm Mrs. Goldberg. Dr. Belkin was a very warm person. Very special. And he said, please wait until I finish, and I'll be glad to meet with your nephew. He met me, gave me a little test, and he took me on scholarship. And that's how I got to YU. At any rate, I still promised my mother I would not go to, I would not become an Orthodox rabbi. That was her major fear in life, that I would become an Orthodox rabbi. Because she felt they starved merrily, and she was hoping that I would at least make a living for my family. And I made a promise. I didn't then expect to be an Orthodox rabbi. I wanted to be a lawyer, I thought. Then, in my sophomore year, or maybe go one step earlier, I took Latin, Professor Louis Feldman at YU. Fantastic. He taught Latin, Greek, and intellectual history. And I majored in Louis Feldman. He was really wonderful and a great scholar. And then in my sophomore year, I pushed myself into Rabbi Soloveitchik's class in Talmud. And it was an experience I will never forget. He literally brought the Talmud page alive, and he showed conceptually how the greatest ideas can be found within the Talmudic debate. And it was not just mathematics 613, but it was philosophy and theology combined, with a good deal of hermeneutics, obviously, and logic. I was totally entranced. And especially so when he described himself as an halachic existentialist who believes that halacha deals with the most fundamental existential human questions of humanity. And I knew that I wanted to study with him, and I wanted to study toward nation, and I wanted to be a rabbi. The question was how to break it to my mother. So I called Professor Feldman 10 o'clock one night to make an appointment because it was bothering me and I couldn't really study. He told me to come right away. We met and he gave me the best advice I ever got from anyone. An advice that I've given to others. He said, if your vocation and your avocation is the same, and if you see it as a calling which will make the world a better place, you will live a blessed life. And the chances are, if you're doing what you really love to do, that you will succeed. And then your mother will be very happy. And that's what happened. And the rest of my academic career was with Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Do you remember the first thing that you learned when you came into a shir? The first thing they were learning, and what idea sort of struck you that this is? You talked about fundamental ideas arising out of the Talmud. Do you remember some of those things?
Yes, of course. I don't remember the first, but of course. We learned the Mishnah, Bava Kamma, Adam Muad La'olam. A man is always considered as having been forewarned, an adult human being. Adam Muad La'olam is always considered as having been forewarned. And he said that if they taught Kogito Ergo Sum, I think, therefore I am. If Aristotle felt that a human being was a communicating animal, Judaism would teach, I take responsibility, therefore I am. When he taught the laws of mourning and how the festivals cancel out the laws of mourning, he explained how one of the answers to death, or at least if not the answers, but one of the responses to death, is the festival itself, which speaks to the eternity of Israel, and the fact that although the angel of death can get every human being, Reb Yisrael, the angel of death never conquers Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. And if a person lives to see his children and grandchildren continuing the narrative that he believes in and taught them, he lives through them. After all, it's the same DNA. And that because the eternity of Israel is expressed within the festival trumps mourning, because the festival gives eternal life to those who understand that the continuity of the Jewish people, of the peoplehood of Israel, that continuity confirms every individual's participation in eternity. Those were the kinds of classes that made a real difference.
Let's move a little bit forward to, I'm interested in the origins of how Lincoln Square came about, and I want to check something with you. Edward Abramson has written that Lincoln Square was initially created as part of an urban renewal real estate scheme. It says that in 1964, the developers of a new condo complex called Lincoln Towers, which was built as part of a larger municipal effort to gentrify what had become a kind of quasi-slum, decided it would be advantageous to provide a location for a small kind of fledgling local congregation in the hope of, I guess, attracting more upscale Jewish tenants. So I'm wondering if that's true, and I'm wondering how they came to offer you the rabbi's position. I think you were 23 at the time. Is that correct?
Okay. 24, actually.
24.
It wasn't quite part of the urban renewal program. It became part of the urban renewal program because you wanted to build a shul. Lincoln's Square Synagogue, the whole Lincoln Center area, was part of what had once been Hell's Kitchen, the West Side Story, if you ever saw the play, came from that area. That was the area I described earlier. I think it was Mayor Beam, actually, who felt that people would come back from the suburbs after their children grew up, and he wanted to bring them back into the inner city. And he had the idea of gentrifying Hell's Kitchen, and he did that with Lincoln Center to a great extent, high class or at least upper middle class luxury apartment housing, and that was Lincoln Towers, and that was an important scheme to bring people back into the city. By that time, I graduated at age 23. And I was teaching at Yeshiva University, Bible and Talmud. And that's what I wanted to do. But I felt very grateful because they had given me free education all the years. And I would have liked to make a nice donation. I was making $4,200 a year at the time. I thought I was doing very well. I was married by that time and had a daughter. Where I am in the story, my wife was pregnant with what became our first daughter. But I didn't have the kind of money that I could make the kind of donation that I would have liked to do. So I said to Yeshiva University, I'll give you 10 speaking engagements. This is interesting from a synagogue point of view, I think. At that time, there was one synagogue in the area that had been there from before. It was High German Reform. Habonim, it was called. In the 60s. I think it's still there. And the gentrification program began with the building that was financed by, I believe, the Union for Teachers. I think you had got to be a teacher to get into the building, technically. And they built one of those buildings, 303 West 66th Street. Someone who lived there, Danny Morris, whose name was originally Daniel Margolis, he changed it to Mars to be a little more American sounding, and he was trying to escape religion. But he got up one morning, he was a fairly successful real estate person, he got up one morning and looked at the calendar, and it was the second day Rosh Hashanah, and he wanted to go to shul. So he went to Habonim, and they wouldn't let him in unless he paid for a ticket. And he said, I'm not religious, but I wouldn't carry money to go to a synagogue. I'll pay after. They wouldn't let him in. He was furious. And he circulated around the building and the area the need for a synagogue. And they started what was then called the Lincoln Square Conservative Synagogue, a three-day-a-year synagogue that met at the Esplanade Hotel. 3 days a year. Even the Sabbath of Repentance that comes out during that time, that would have been a fourth day, they weren't interested in that at all. And they started for 1 year. That was 1963. And they had about 200 to 250 people came to the Esplanade Hotel. They were pretty happy with the rabbi. They paid him $500. He asked for $1,000 for the next year. They thought it was strange that he didn't try to get them to come the Sabbath of Repentance as well. So they thought they might look for a rabbi elsewhere. It was called Conservative Synagogue. It was mixed seated. At that time, in America, in New York especially, the conservative movement was doing extremely well. And their most important motto was, their branding statement was, a family that prays together stays together. And the mixed seating was a big issue. Yeshiva University also had a philosophy at that time called Kibush Kihilot, to try to conquer back synagogues, because there were many shuls that took out the separation between the sexes, the mechitzot, became conservative in name because the mixed seating was so important for them. Yeshiva University tried very hard to get some of their graduates to go into those synagogues and try to rechange the synagogue. So since I promised them 10 speaking engagements, that group turned to Yeshiva University, would Yeshiva send someone? And Yeshiva said they would certainly send someone. They sent me to talk to them, making it very clear at my request that I was not going to go as the rabbi. I wouldn't go to a mixed-seated synagogue. However, I would speak in favor of the Yeshiva University rabbi. Anyway, I spent a Saturday night at the home of this Daniel Morris, meeting with the board of the shul. I spent about 4 or 5 hours. They had all of the old bugaboos about what orthodoxy meant. Like, you know, you husbands and wives slept with a sheet between them. All sorts of crazy old wives stories. And I tried to explain what modern orthodoxy was all about. At the end of the discussion, they said, fine, well, you're hired. I said, I'm not coming. I'm not interested in the rabbinate. And I'm certainly not interested in going to a mixed-seated synagogue. Yeshiva University will service you. You know how it is. The more you say no, they say yes. If I would have said yes right away, maybe they would have said no. But it went back and forth. I went to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I don't think you should go. You shouldn't destroy your reputation. Usually, The rabbi doesn't change the synagogue. The synagogue changes the rabbi. You have a very good future in front of you. He would suggest I not go. Dr. Belkin called me in, and Dr. Belkin said he wants me to go. I told Dr. Belkin that my Rosh Yeshiva told me not to go. Now, I didn't understand the politics of the situation. At Yeshiva University, the president was also the Rosh Yeshiva. He said, I'm your Rosh Yeshiva. He was a student of the Chofetz Chaim and a great Talmudic scholar. But everything, all of the pressures of being the president of Yeshiva University made it impossible for him to give regular classes. And he said that he was he said he's the Rosh Yeshiva and he's telling me to go. So I said to him, and I felt very badly, I still feel badly when I think about it, I said, but I never learned Torah from you. And he got angry. And he said, tomorrow your Rosh Yeshiva will tell you to go. The next day I walked into my classroom to teach, and there was a note for me to see Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I never told you that it was forbidden for you to go. I said it wasn't for your advantage to go. Dr. Belkin feels he knows you, and he knows the area because he lives on the west side, which is the case. Rabbi Soloveitchik lived in Brookline, Massachusetts, and came in for 3 days a week to teach at YU. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I bow to Dr. Belkin's view. If you don't take a salary from them, and you don't pray with them, but you run the services, and you should cry to get a regular Shabbat minyan going, Dr. Belkin feels, and he convinced me, that you'll be able to make the change. I came away a bit confused and afraid that I got into a political imbroglio that was beyond my ken. I didn't know what to do. So I called 770 the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because I felt very seriously that Rav Soloveitchik was the Lamdan Hador, the greatest Talmudic scholar in the generation. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was Manhig Hador, the leader of the generation, who took responsibility for every Jew. And I felt that he could answer the question best. He saw me right away. He suggested that I go. He said to me when I walked into the office, he said to me, without any introductions, he seemed to know exactly why I was there. And he said to me, there's a religious battle going on for the soul of the Jewish people. Sometimes when there's a battle going on, because that was a time that, I think different from today, there was a real battle. The conservative movement was fighting to overtake Orthodox shuls. And it was a battle then. And he said that in every battle, sometimes people have to dress up like the enemy and seem to be in the enemy camp. I wouldn't consider the conservative movement today the enemy camp. But at that time, with all of your public relations, etc., Orthodoxy was very much embattled. It's necessary for people to go into the enemy camp to be like undercover agents. And he looked at me, and the greatness of the Lubavitcher Rebbe is that he didn't gain disciples the way he empowered generals. And he said to me, you can not only win the battle, but even the war. And made me feel very much empowered. And therefore I accepted the challenge. And we started where Shani Yom Kippur went very well. And they were thrilled because I didn't take a salary. Yeshiva University gave me $2,000 for taking on the challenge. So I did get paid when we started the regular Shabbat minyan. I did get money out of it. But I lived according to what Rabbi Soloveitchik had asked me to do. And by Purim, we had a separation in the shul between the men and the women. And Lincoln Square Synagogue developed very well into an Orthodox synagogue. But it wasn't really, it was part of urban renewal, but it wasn't a city project. It was a private project.
But you were doing things that were new. You had, you know, I think you're being a bit sort of modest here. I mean, in a short amount of time, you're really drawing a lot of people to the shul, and eventually, like, kind of standing room only, and kind of people who didn't normally attend shul. You were getting really sophisticated young urban Jews, and they were attracted by your personality, but also, I think you were, what kind of approaches were you using to reach out to unaffiliated Jews?
Look, I had an advantage. I had never grown up in a synagogue. I didn't know what rabbis were supposed to be doing. I did go to Yeshiva University youth seminars. That was a very important part of everything. Yeshiva University ran, at that time, seminars for youth, high school youth who were not attending yeshivot. And I taught them. And I saw that Judaism had the power to grab young minds. You just had to teach them and love them and do not only intellectual learning, but existential experiencing. You have to not only teach about the philosophy of the Sabbath and God's creation of the world and the philosophy of what the human being is, from a Jewish perspective, biblical perspective. But you have to engage them in Shabbosing. That Shabbat has to be a verb, not only a noun. You have to teach experientially. And it worked very well with the seminar youth. So I figured that would work in the synagogue setting as well. I tried to speak about relevant topics. I taught a Bible class. I began really not with a service. I began with Torah classes. Once we got the apartment, apartment 1D, 150 West End Avenue, 40-story building. And I taught Bible. And then I taught the Jewish attitudes towards sex, the sexual ethic. That went over very well. It was the Vietnam War period. I taught about the possibilities of conscientious objection. I tried to be as relevant as I could and make Judaism as relevant as I could and show that fealty to Jewish law was not at all out of sync with real relevance to life. And it worked. It worked very, very well. We always had at least 10 people around our Sabbath table for meals. My wife would go to the hospital to give birth, and the Shabbat that she came back, there were 10 people around the table. And a lot of open discussion. And the synagogue grew like Topsy and developed very well.
Do you think any of it had to do with the feeling of the time, like the 1960s, a kind of time of upheaval, a little bit of an existential crisis? People are debating the question of God's existence, and people are looking for meaning. Do you think that kind of dovetailed at all with...
Undoubtedly. As I said, go back to Rabbi Soloveitchik's initial definition. I believe very strongly that Judaism speaks to the most existential questions. Probably the biggest existential question is, what am I doing here in the world? How can I make my life purposeful? For me, that was the cardinal issue that Judaism dealt with. It was also the New Age. Mm-hmm. People were looking for new ways. And although I was teaching halachic Judaism, for many of them, certainly the manner in which it was being taught was different than what they were used to. And I think that was an important issue. The second important thing, and I think Edward Abramson has captured that in the book, The Circle Around the Square, I think he calls the book. It was the time of Soviet Jewry struggling to be freed from the Soviet Union. And the issue of Soviet Jewry really emanated from our synagogue. There was a very special Jew named Yaakov Birnbaum who visited the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain. And just about the time when Elie Wiesel was preparing to write Jews of Silence, he came to New York with the message what was really happening to Soviet Jews at the heels of the Holocaust and the critique to the Jewish community, that the Jewish community in New York and America had been too silent during the Holocaust. And that became the raison d'etre of the synagogue. And it became a very real issue. And the synagogue adopted the Soviet Jewry struggle. And that welded into that kind of strong action, demonstration, etc., welded into the modern orthodoxy that we were teaching in practice, Shabbat, the festivals, and I think helped tremendously.
You know, when people talk about, I'm just interested in the kind of outreach that modern orthodoxy was doing. And you know, when people talk about Kiruv today, they usually associate it with other sorts of movements. They talk about Chabad and they talk about, you know, other organizations. Why do you think that modern orthodoxy is not so associated with outreach anymore, and what do you think can be done about it?
Well, it hadn't been associated before, actually. I think we were the first outreach synagogue, yeah. And I think as far as that was concerned, it did make an important change in the mentality of many of the synagogues and their rabbis. But, and to a certain extent, that's one of the things that we're trying to do right now, right, in terms of what Ortor Stone is trying to do, the kinds of rabbis we produce, and we're now starting Batei Or Torah, like Or Torah houses, to try to continue to reach out to the unaffiliated. I think the PR of Chabad is very good, and I think Chabad has been wonderfully successful, and I take my hat off to them. And many of the things that they're doing, we're also doing, and we did. I mean, one of the things that I'm very proud of is, we had a sukkah mobile before Chabad did. So there were certain things that maybe they even learned from us a little bit. But I always felt very much, very close to Chabad.
I want to talk about the transition between the American years and the Israeli years, beginning with when did it enter your consciousness that you wanted to make Aliyah. You made Aliyah, you decided to make Aliyah in 1983, I think you went. How were you thinking about it, and when did you first break it to the congregation, and what was their reaction, and also what did the Rebbe say to you about it?
Well, I always brokered to the congregation. In other words, I never signed the contract. I always told them that at first opportunity, I would move to Israel. I believe very strongly that the place for every Jew today, the greatest challenge, the greatest adventure of our people in 2,000 years, is Israel. I used to be angry, especially at Orthodox Jews who weren't coming to Israel, because I felt that it's a central commandment of the Torah. Very often I would speak and say, you know, it's too bad that moving to Israel is not a chumrah, a stringency. Because then all of Lakewood and Borough Park and Stamford Hill would be running to Israel. It's just a central commandment. V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem ba. You shall inherit the land and dwell in it. Book of Numbers, 53:33. It's a central mitzvah. And that seems to grab the Jewish people today less than a stringency that everybody is somehow taking on. I met my wife in Israel at the end of 1961. And we fell in love there and became engaged there and promised each other that we would live in Israel. And for me, it was always very important. And I explained to the synagogue that I was on the way. Of course, you know, on the way is a very long term. And when I met my wife and when we became engaged, she was only 16. She was in a college group. It was the summer after the year that I spent in Israel in 60-61, between college and rabbinical school. And she was in the college group. So she was on her way to Barnard, so I assumed she was 18. But she was only 16. So her parents were not too happy. And we had a kind of Romeo and Juliet relationship for a while. And when my daughter became 16, I wrote my in-laws a letter of apology. I understood how they felt. But finally, my in-laws said, as long as we wait 2 years to get married until she was 18, which I think was logical and intelligent, and not leave for Israel until she graduates Barnard, they were okay with it. And we had a very wonderful relationship till the end of their lives. Very special people. But it was clear to us that we wanted to live in Israel. I got involved in the synagogue. I didn't want to leave it until I really felt that I had a solid Orthodox synagogue, that I had done the job. And that didn't happen until 1970. And then we built the building, and every summer we would go to Israel, either as camp counselors or teaching in some kind of program for the summers in Israel, and always looking for a job. And I couldn't get a job. They didn't even give me a chance to give a model class. I would have been satisfied to go as a high school rebbe. I love to teach. I love to learn. I would have been very, very happy as a high school rebbe. I couldn't get a job. Kelman family is a little bit involved. I'll tell you how. There was a rabbi who was in charge of synagogues and rabbinical positions in Jerusalem and the Negev. He heard that I was looking for a job, invited me to his home on a Saturday night in Jerusalem, and he said that there is a job open in Arad. And Arad was a just starting pioneer kind of city. We weren't quite thinking of Arad at that time. But I was very anxious, and I said, it sounds great. And he told me, just you could start on Rosh Hashanah. It was the summertime. You can start Rosh Hashanah. I went home to my wife, and I said, listen, I think I have a job. The rabbi of Arad. It's a starting city. It sounds very exciting. My wife said, what's the salary? I said, I never asked him. My wife is the very practical one of my family, and she handles all the finances. I never thought about that. So I went back to him, and I said, what's the salary? He said, Rabbi Riskin, you could depend on me. Don't worry. He said, smoke alai. You listen to an Israeli say, smoke alai, run the other way. Depend on me. He said, do you ever see a rabbi in Israel die of starvation? He'll get a salary like everybody has a salary. I go back to my wife, don't be foolish. You ever see anybody die in the streets of Israel of starvation? He said, there's no problem. I'll get a salary like every other rabbi. And we really wanted to get to Israel. I was all excited. I wrote a letter to the congregation explaining that I would stay in Israel because money going back and forth would have been difficult. I would come back myself for the high holidays to the congregation through Sukkot. By that time, they would be able to find a replacement. It was a plum of a synagogue. And the family would stay in Arad. And I had it sort of figured out. And that Sunday morning, I went to deposit the letter by mail and to make a Thanksgiving prayer at the Kotel. I'm on the way to the Kotel, the Western Wall. And I see Rabbi Kelman, one of the Rabbi Kelman brothers, who I believe was the head of a women's school in Ulpana, a high school in Brooklyn. And I was very anxious to tell somebody about my news. And I said, Shalom Aleichem, how are you? What's happening with you? What are you doing? Just figuring an opening, you know, I'll start with him and then I'll tell him what's with me. And he says to me, I was here for a year sabbatical, but I'm staying, and I have a rabbinical position. I said, yes, where? He said, in Arad. Who gave it to you? Well, the same person who gave it to me. But I didn't tell him that. To say I was devastated is an understatement. I went back to the gentleman who told me to rely on him. And I said, you know, I met Rabbi Kelman. And he told me that he's going as the rabbi of Arad. We're both Ashkenazim. It can't be an Ashkenaz rabbi and a Sephardi rabbi. What I remember about the incident is he didn't even blink an eye. And he said, listen, we don't, tell you the truth, he says, we don't have any kind of budget for any rabbi in Arad, not for you and not for him. And we live on government budgeting. I know your congregation and I know his congregation. You'll tell them you're coming to Israel as a rabbi in Arad, and they'll insist that it be a Shnat Shabbaton, a sabbatical. The same thing with his position. They'll give him another year for sabbatical. And when when you go in sabbatical, it's 50% of the American salary, which is a very generous salary for Israel. You'll both be working at your positions, American positions, salary, 50% salary. You'll both work very hard. By that time, it will be clear that we need a budget for a rabbi in Arad. And one of the two of you will stay. He had it all figured out. I was very upset. And that almost put an end to my dreams of moving to Israel. I really looked for a teaching position. That would have been fine with me. But as I said, they didn't even give me a chance to give a class. Later on, one of the people who interviewed me explained, I didn't have a beard. And in Israel, you just can't be in the area of religious teaching, certainly at that time, without a beard. It wasn't the culture. If someone would have told me that, I would have grown a beard very quickly. I can do that very easily. That doesn't take anything except secondary sexual characteristics. But I didn't know, and now I wouldn't grow a beard if my life depended on it, because I was so upset at the fact that that should have been an issue. But I didn't know if, you know, I just felt that maybe my dreams for Israel would not be possible.
Just to clarify, what year is this?
This is the early 70s.
Okay.
Early to mid 70s. Then I was invited to a conference in Lviv, 75. A theological conference, a number of rabbis from America, together with the leadership of the religious kibbutz movement in Israel. Along with me were Rabbi Spiro and Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and Rabbi Saul Berman. It was a very lovely group of rabbis from America at that time. And each of us were given a kibbutz for Shabbat. And the kibbutz that I was given was Ein Tzurim, which had been in Gush Etzion, where Efrat is, initially. And that whole area was destroyed by the Jordanian League in 1948 and reestablished near Kiryat Malachi, Ashkelon. And there was the kibbutz. And I was invited as a scholar of residence to Kibbutz Ein Tzurim. First for the Shabbat after the conference at Lviv, and then for the following summer together with my family. A very fascinating individual named Moshe Moshkovitz, who is one of these amazing Israelis, and Israel has these kind of amazing people, who without any kind of salary, because he worked in Masuot Yitzchak, he has a settlement farm, kind of. And he just does it because it's a mitzvah to do it. Starts communities. Brings over people. He brought Rabbi Lichtenstein to Yeshiva Taratzion. He started Alon Shvut. And he had a dream, his dream, to start Efrat. And that Efrat would be the ring, the diamond in the ring around Jerusalem to protect Jerusalem. Because right after Gush Etzion fell in 1948, the old city of Jerusalem fell. Efrat is 250 meters above Jerusalem and is strategically very important if we're to keep Jerusalem. When Golda Meir came see the territory that we liberated after the Six-Day War, and she saw Efrat, She said, this is beautiful. It's the Switzerland of Israel. I prefer to call Switzerland the Efrat of Europe, but it depends on perspective. She said, it's the Switzerland of Israel. And there will be a city here. She wrote this into the law books. There will be a city here, but it must be started by two groups of new Olim to Israel, new immigrants to Israel, from advanced educational and financial countries, like America and South Africa. And Moshe Mashkevitz dreamt of starting Efrat in this manner. At any rate, I'm Kibbutz Ein Surim. I'm giving classes every evening. Moshe Mashkevitz comes to one of my classes, and he says to me afterwards, what are you doing in America? We need you in Israel. I said, great, that's three people who think so, my wife and me and you. I've been trying to get a job, couldn't get a job. He said, listen to me, in Israel you don't try to get a job. A group of Americans once asked Mayor Dizengoff, the mayor of Tel Aviv, how do you become the mayor of a city in Israel? And Mayor Dizengoff said, in Israel, you want to be the mayor of a city? Build the city. So he said to me, you become my partner. You will work at getting a group from New York and its periphery, from your synagogue, and from South Africa, because you speak English. You get the two groups that Golda Meir wanted. I'll take care of all the bureaucracy to get the city started. We'll be partners. We'll start the city. And he said about himself, I will be the mayor and you will be the rabbi. Now, he couldn't guarantee. Both things are elections. But it sounded to me like it would be possible. I shook his hand. I prayed mincha on the spot, the afternoon prayer. And we started to work together. I started an organization called Reshit Geula, the beginning of redemption, to get people to sign up on Efrat. We had 190 families put $1,500 down to come to Efrat from New York and its periphery, and 75 families from South Africa, from Johannesburg mostly, and Cape Town a little bit. And it happened. The rest is history.
What were the? I imagine it was difficult in the early years, right? To where you would have liked it. Was there ever a moment, even a fraction of a second, where you thought, "I made a mistake. I shouldn't have left America"?
You're reading my mind. Yeah. You know, everything is very romantic when you leave. They made parties, they gave me a Sefer Torah, maybe they wanted me to leave, I don't know. But it was very exciting, leaving, and leaving for an ideal. When we got to Efrat at that time, this is 1983, the winters were very cold, that winter especially was extremely cold. There was no heat, no electricity. The streets weren't paved. And I wasn't elected rabbi yet. The elections were supposed to be that February. And they didn't even want to give me an exam. I had to take an extra exam to be a city rabbi because I didn't have a beard. They didn't even want to give me an exam. Everything was extremely up in the air. And I would get up in the middle of the night with a cold sweat. My wife, who was really an amazing person, my wife would get up whenever I got up. And she knew exactly what was bothering me. And she said, don't worry. If I have to do sponge, if I have to clean floors, we're going to make it. And if it's not in Efrat, we made Aliyah to Israel, we'll make it. Don't worry. But better said than done. I was extremely worried. I wasn't sure what to do. I began to think I made a mistake. I'm going to tell you something that to my mind is extremely important. While I was having these second thoughts, and that's when I started wearing the suit and the tie every day, because that was my kind of success uniform in New York. So I started wearing that in Israel too. And I wasn't quite sure how to go. Yonatan Ben-Ari, who was in charge of security in Israel, in Efrat, came into our apartment with an Uzi and said to me, Kvod Harav, you have guard duty tonight between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. My wife heard this. Our 4 children were there. And she said in a stage whisper, if Abba is guarding us tonight, maybe we should spend the night in Jerusalem. Given what my wife said, and given the way I looked at the Uzi, Yonatan Ben-Ari said, Kvod Harav, you mean you don't know how to shoot an Uzi? I said, shoot an Uzi? I don't think I ever killed a mosquito in my life. He took me out to a little forest, which is still in Efrat, which I affectionately called Central Park West Bank. And it didn't take more than 30 minutes to teach me how to shoot an Uzi. Unfortunately, it's not so hard. And that night from 2 to 6 a.m., I had guard duty around Efrat. Well, Efrat, the whole of Efrat at that time was maybe 65 families, and it was a very small circumference of homes. You could do the whole circle in maybe 20 minutes. In the stillness of the night, we started to talk. Yossi Beck still lives in Israel. He's actually the president now. He was an important person in the police system in Israel. And he's now the president of the first synagogue in Efrat. Anyway, he was coming to my Gemara classes. I was giving classes, obviously. And that's if I can't teach, I can't live. So I was teaching from the time I arrived in Efrat. And he was coming, and his Hebrew is flawless. And he says to me as we're walking, doing guard duty, Kvod Harav, tell me, what was your life like before you came on Aliyah? And with great feelings of nostalgia, and maybe I made a mistake, I'm describing life at Lincoln Square that I missed, frankly. And then I said to him, what was your life like before you made Aliyah? He said, I was a Christian. And I was going to church with my brother and father, occasionally my mother, every Sunday. But he tells me that somehow he felt some kind of tie to the Jewish people. He never understood why. One of the Scandinavian countries, that's where he lived. And at the end of high school, everybody had to write a term paper. He wrote a term paper about Israel, the burgeoning state of Israel. Was conscripted to the army for a year. They have national conscription for everybody. And you have to check off a clergyman, and he checked off a rabbi he wanted to see. And he told the rabbi he's not Jewish, he's not even interested in becoming Jewish, but he's interested in Judaism, he doesn't know why. And the rabbi suggested books, and they had good conversations. At the end of the year, gets back, didn't want to go to university because he didn't know what he wanted to major in. And then the Yom Kippur War broke out, 1973. And they were looking for volunteers from the diaspora to help, especially the kibbutzim. The Yom Kippur War was a very difficult war in Israel, and they needed help. At least, if the kibbutznikim were fighting the war, they needed people to take care of the crops back home. So he tells me that he and three of his Christian friends volunteered and went to a non-religious kibbutz. He loved the land, he loved the people, he learned the language very quickly, and he was very well acclimated. He read a great deal, even more about Judaism. He wanted to keep kosher, so he became vegetarian. He wanted to keep Shabbat. So the head of the kibbutz said, if you want to keep Shabbat, this kibbutz is not for you. But let me suggest to you, there's an opan for conversion in Kfar Etzion, in Gush Etzion. Why don't you go there? He did. He went to the opan, which was really a conversion school at that time. And it didn't take a few months. He got a date to go to the mikveh to become Jewish. All of a sudden, he figured, I'd better go home and tell my parents. All of this he's telling me in the middle of the night. Guard duty. He said, I wrote my parents. I said, I need tickets. I have to make a very important decision. I want to discuss it with you. They sent him tickets. After eating a vegetarian dinner at home with his parents, he announced at the dinner table that he wants to convert to Judaism and link his destiny with the state of Israel and the Jewish people. He tells me his mother fainted dead away. When she was revived, she said, you don't have to convert. You're Jewish because I'm Jewish. Yossi Beck, still in the frat. You're Jewish because I'm Jewish. My father was at the chazan, the cantor, in a small shtetl in Poland. And when the Nazis took over Poland, there was a Kinderaktion. And that was the child at home. And my father, the chazan, in the corner, cried out, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. They shot him dead. And they took me. And in the cattle car to Theresienstadt, his mother told him, I took an oath that if I ever get out of this hellhole, it's going to be as a Christian. Because if there was one Holocaust, there'll be another. And I don't want my children and grandchildren to suffer like I'm suffering. She got out. She had no one to answer to because all her blood relatives were murdered by the Nazis. And she told him that until this point, the only other person who knows of my Jewish background is your father. But I'm living my life as a Christian. All I could think of were the verses in the Torah, in Devarim, Perek Lamed, Perek chapter 30, 1 to 10, where Moshe Rabbeinu says 4,000 years ago, even if you're scattered to the ends of the heavens, that's after the second destruction of the second temple. God will gather you up and take you from the ends of the heavens and restore you to Israel. I said to myself, this is what's happening here in Israel. How can I think of leaving? The Jews have come home after 2,000 years, just as the Bible promised. This is where the action is. So that ended all of my feelings that maybe I was making a mistake. I was sure that I made the right decision. I went forward, and thank God things have worked out very well, beyond my dreams.
And the final part of our conversation, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing in present. I'm especially interested in the work you're doing with women. you're well aware that the role of women is a sort of a hotly debated topic in modern Orthodoxy, and you've been somewhat pioneering in this domain. And in 2014, the first ever book of halachic decisions written by women who were ordained to serve as poskim, I'm speaking about Edith Bartov and Anat Novoselsky, was published, and they were trained under your auspices after completing Midrash of Lindenbaum's Women's College five-year ordination course in advanced studies in halacha, as well as they passed examinations which were cliven to the rabbinate's requirement for men. I'm wondering where you think modern Orthodoxy is headed in this sphere. In other words, do you believe that women will play more and more prominent roles, including clerical ones?
Both Rav Soloveitchik and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, both of them said to me, obviously at different times, that the major problem facing Jewry of the then 20th century is women within Orthodox Judaism. Both of them felt that this was a critical area. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, in fact, said to me that Rabbi Groner, who was one of his close Hasidim in Australia and founded the Jewish community in a very real way in Melbourne, was giving for 50 years, I checked this out because I traveled to Australia every year during the last decade at least. And the fact is that he was teaching Gemara with Rishonim, going through Masechet after Masechet with a group of very high-powered women with the direction of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe believed very strongly that one of the signs of the Messianic Age, I had a yichidut, I had a session with him for an hour and 55 minutes on this whole question of feminism. It was very important to me since my grandmother, who was my first Rebbe, and she learned Talmud. The Lubavitcher Rebbe quoted to me Jeremiah chapter 31, in which Jeremiah says that in the Messianic Age, Nekeva tesovev gaver, the women will run circuits around the men. And he interpreted that in accordance with the Zohar HaKadosh, that Od Yishama Ba'orei Yehuda V'chutzot Yerushalayim Kol Sason V'kol Simcha Kol Chatan V'kol Kala, the voice of the brides, the voice of the women, especially in teaching Torah of loving kindness, which will bring about the Messianic Age. Rabbi Soloveitchik pioneered the importance of teaching women Gemara on the highest level. And the rights of women to reach expertise in all areas of halacha. That's what I do. We have a school for women judges as well. I believe it is very halachically viable. One of the things that we first started in Efrat, in Jerusalem, Midrash Lindenbaum was in Jerusalem, but during my Efrat period, was a school for women advocates in the religious law courts, which meant teaching women the rights of women to divorce, which is quite clearly and specifically discussed within the Talmud. And there are even five instances within the Talmud when the rabbis abrogated marriages if the husband was acting like a scoundrel and didn't want to give a divorce. So we created a school for women advocates to lobby for divorce, very successfully, we have some 140 women in the field, practicing in the field, and bringing hundreds of divorces every year to fruition. I've already given to the publisher a book of halachic articles, one of which is the possibility to do exactly this, to abrogate a marriage, kiddushin, if the husband acts like a scoundrel. There's no reason why a woman should be held up by her husband. The Rambam puts it very, very well in his laws, in the Mishneh Torah. Nishotenu einan kishvuyot etzel ba'alehen. Our women cannot be captive to their husbands. And you have to do whatever we can do in order to free women who have difficulties like this. And the women's voice in Torah, likewise, must be heard and will be heard. Now, I don't allow women to be balot kriya, to read from the Torah publicly in a mixed community of men and women, or to serve as cantors in a mixed community of men and women. Because women are not obligated halachically for public prayer or public Torah reading, so they cannot discharge the obligation for the men who are obligated. But other than that, women can certainly teach halacha, women can certainly give sermons, women can certainly visit the sick and comfort the mourner. Women can make halachic decisions, as you see in the two books of Responsa, the book of Responsa that these two women wrote, which have received excellent reviews. And fundamentally, this is accepted in Israel. I didn't receive any flack. I'm a city rabbi. We got a good deal of publicity when we graduated these first two women musmachot. Now, we supply rabbis all over the world. We have now some 500 rabbis and educators in 500 communities all over the world. North America, South America, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, South Africa, Australia. Wherever our rabbis go, they try very hard to be sensitive to women's needs. A typical rabbi in a synagogue very often is expected to be the Baal Korei and the Baal Tefillah. So therefore, I don't think that a woman can be the sole rabbi in a synagogue. But she can certainly be a member of the clergy. And I've just invited a woman, a very special woman, Dr. Jenny Rosenfeld, to be my assistant, especially in terms of women's issues and marital issues within the community.
Something that's been in the paper a lot and being spoken about by many Jews is conversion practices. And I'm wondering how you would change sort of current conversion practices, especially in the state of Israel.
First of all, I believe that Judaism historically has been very much in favor of reaching out to those who want to be reached in terms of conversion. We never taught non salus extra ecclesia, that there is no salvation outside of the synagogue, to paraphrase. We've always taught historically that as long as someone keeps the basic seven laws of morality, Noahide laws of morality, that individual has a share in the world to come and in God's grace, however that may be defined. And that it's not necessary for a Christian to convert. However, all of our sources encourage us to be very user-friendly to those who who seek conversion. Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon says that the mitzvah, the positive commandment of loving the stranger, begins when the convert begins to suggest that he might want to learn something about Judaism. And there's a Mishnah that everybody knows, but very few people internalize. Heyumi Talmidav Shel Aaron, be amongst the disciples of Aaron. Love peace, pursue peace. Echol v'tabriot, love humanity. Umakorvan l'Torah, and bring them close to Torah. We just read about Abraham in Parshat Lech Lecha. And Abraham was a missionary for God. And in the mitzvah, in the Rambam, Book of Commandments, Commandment 3, to love God, he says part of this mitzvah is to make God beloved amongst all of humanity. That goes beyond the 7 Noahide laws that don't ask to know about God necessarily. So, we are to be user-friendly towards converts. The religious establishment, the chief rabbinate in Israel, is not at all user-friendly to converts. Much the opposite. They're very, very discouraging. Which is not Talmudic law. So that's the first thing that has to change. We have to be willing and make it a point to embrace people who are seeking conversion. Now this is especially true in Israel. You have to understand that in Israel there are 350,000. You know, I was involved in the Soviet Jewry movement, I said before. So there are 1.1, 1.2 individuals from the former Soviet Union who are now in Israel, and they're in Israel under the right of return. The right of return is a wonderful law which says that anyone who is a Jew and wants to move to Israel has of right citizenship, because between 1939 and 1945 many Jews wanted to leave Europe and they couldn't go anywhere, and they couldn't go to Israel either because the British who held the mandate didn't allow them to. So Israel is founded on the basis of the right of return, that they can come to Israel of right. Who is a Jew? So in this Chok HaShvut, the law of the right of return, it says anyone who is Jew enough to be sent to Auschwitz has to be Jew enough to be accepted right of return as an Israeli citizen. Now, if someone had one Jewish grandparent, paternally or maternally, he would have been sent to Auschwitz. So there are 350,000, approximately, Israeli citizens from the former Soviet Union who are Israeli under the right of return, but they are not halachic Jews, because halachic Jews goes by the maternal side, not the paternal side. However, the overwhelming number of Gaonim and Rishonim have a special place for what's called Zera Yisrael, the paternal side. And if you are Jewish paternally, you do require conversion. But all the authorities that I know say bend over backwards to try to bring them into Judaism. The situation in Israel today with 350,000 people who are Israelis but not Jews halachically will make the intermarriage problem in Israel rival that of the intermarriage problem in the diaspora. So what we must do, I think, as a major issue facing the Jewish people in Israel is try to convert as many of those as possible in an active campaign. That's what I'm involved
with. Final questions. What's been the most surprising thing about Israel for you?
It's enormous success on every level. I don't think we appreciate what's happened in Israel. Less than 7 decades. There's no country in less than 7 decades that have been constantly at war with our enemies who have made such magnificent strides in terms of university, in terms of education, in terms of startup. You know, the very, very wonderful book, Dan Senior, Startup Nation, about Israel. We've been astonishingly and amazingly successful. What I am most surprised about is two things at the same time. You know, there's a very famous professor and Rosh Yeshiva, Harav Hagon Dumbledore of Hogwarts Yeshiva, of Harry Potter fame, who says that success in life has much more to do with decisions one makes than it does with the gifts that one is given. The two greatest decisions I made was marrying my wife and moving to Israel. And I am really a bit surprised at how much success I've had in Israel in order to change society to a great extent, in terms of the educational network that spreads throughout the world that was created. It was a tremendous yata d'shmaya. And the realization of the dream has been much greater than the dream. Efrat now is nearing 12,000 residents, 7 hills, 38 synagogues, a whole plethora of educational institutions, and developing magnificently. So that was my first surprise. My second surprise, antithetically, I always wondered how it could be that the lies that Goebbels told about the Jewish people spread throughout the world, and how quick the world was to eat those lies up and cooperate with Hitler in murdering Jews between 1939 and 1945. I never dreamt that the world would learn so little from the Holocaust years. Because the same lies are being told again and again within the halls of the United Nations by leaders of almost every state, especially Europe, with the almost sole exception of your blessed Prime Minister. For whose health I pray every day. I'm wearing my Canadian tie, the maple. Because I truly, truly believe that he is a great person and stands for a morality that the American president has forgotten. Tragically. Tragically. And America has not yet even recognized the evil of extremist Islam. They're so busy trying to be politically correct. That's right. And that's a terrible tragedy. So those are my two surprises. I hope that what I feel on the positive step will spread to the political arena as well.
So in conclusion, I'm just going to tell you something about Rabbi Riskin. We've been in your office together a number of times, and I've met Rabbi Riskin's secretary, a wonderful woman named Mickey Mervis, and I've seen his travel schedule. And may God grant you the indefatigable energy that you seem to have, because it's truly unbelievable to see how this person operates in the world. So may God give you bracha now and for the decades that I'm sure you still have to do the work you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.